Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 637, October 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell. It's time for another edition of Old Movie Club.
Old Movie Club.
This is a very old movie, so old that I was alive and well when it was released, as I believe was my entire panel. So old, such an old movie.
That seems to be happening more and more with old movies.
It's not like you could have gone to see it when it came out in the theater.
Yes, when I was 3 years old, I was not. It was rated too high for me. Wouldn't have been allowed in, even though I tried.
Very
to
popular
sneak
with
in.
The toddlers. Yeah. This movie.
Yeah, it is.
Well, the Happy Meal toys are amazing.
It is considered one of the great films. It is 1974's Chinatown, a noir detective movie set in Los Angeles. And to discuss it, I have the following wonderful people. Of course, it wouldn't be Old Movie Club without the person who selects the movies, Philip Michaels. Hello.
Hi, you know what I'm here to discuss tonight, Jason?
What?
The future, Mr. Snails!
No, oh, no.
Yes. Also, I'm here to discuss Chinatown. So
okay, good.
That's, yeah.
Good. That's excellent. Steve Lutz is here. Hello.
Hi there, Jason. I'm here, as usual, to do as little as possible.
Hi!
Shelley Brisbane joins us. Hello.
Hi. I hear the salt is bad for the glass. Is that right?
David J. Lohr is one of my two, helpers.
Associates.
Leg men.
Leg men. The day I'm your leg man, well, I am your leg man.
But my more capable leg man is Dr. Drang. Hello.
Hey, kitty cat.
All right. I wanted to start with an observation about the passage of time, if I may, an opening statement.
Like just, sands through the hourglass.
Just to say, well, okay, so this is, go on Wikipedia and it says it's a neo-noir mystery drama. It is a noir detective story, there's no doubt about it. There's a private detective, there's a femme fatale. Who's posing as a different femme fatale, which is kind of a fun thing. There's a plot that kind of escalates and yet is sort of twisty, and the detective does some stuff that's probably pretty dumb and almost gets himself killed at several points. It's very noir, but of course it was made in 1974, which is when I had that realization that what I want to say is something like, well, this is a 50-year-old movie, but you don't understand. It's in the style of a 70-year-old movie. And I realized that the gap between the classic or 80-year-old movie, the gap between the classic noirs and Chinatown, much less than the gap between Chinatown and us. So yeah. Anyway.
Neo is a relative term.
Just dig a hole and I'll jump in. Any Phil, why did you pick Chinatown?
Pick Chinatown because I loves the noirs. I especially like movies from the 70s, and as you said, the passage of time now allows us to pick movies from the 70s and not go, come on, that's not an old movie. Oh yes it is, friend. Yes, it'll be 50 damn years old in 2 years.
Even Shelley is here. I think that proves the point.
Mm-hmm. People say that all the time.
Oh,
if only it was filmed in black and white, then Erica could have joined us. But alas.
Alas.
Alas, glorious Technicolor.
I remember when I first caught this on some cable channel. I know it didn't have commercials in it, but I remember seeing, oh, Chinatown, I've heard that's really good. I have no idea what it's about or when it was made or who's in it or anything about it. But what the hell, I'll stick through the credits. Like, oh, good, black and white. That's interesting. I know it's an old movie. And then suddenly it was in color and I was like, what? and that was the hook that kept me there until I was hooked by the actual plot of the movie, which didn't take long to get going. But the simple fact that it's like, oh, yeah, this is a pretty old movie. And then, you know, it's in color. And wait, there's Jack Nicholson. I know that guy. And he's not even that that young there.
And this is commonly regarded as one of the greatest screenplays ever written. We can discuss that, certainly, if that holds water. And there's another topic as well that I might surprise you with later when a certain director makes a cameo. So
yeah, I was gonna say Bob Evans, great Hollywood producer, produced this one. I'm sure there are lots of good
also
stories about
mashed
that.
Potatoes.
And yes, indeed. When I asked you why you chose this movie, what I hoped you wouldn't say is, well, Jason, it's part of my campaign to bring Roman Polanski back.
Yes. Exactly.
Hopefully that will be a lonely campaign.
Yes. Cancel culture is such a terrible thing. who among us hasn't committed a horrible sex crime and fled
to France? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and you know, it's not often that you see a film where the director, you know, you think directors kind of emulate the heroes of the films, and this one, not so much.
Well, you know, it just depends on what your perspective is as to who the hero is.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Hmm.
Yeah, the first time I saw this was on a PBS station in 1985 in Philadelphia, and so no commercials, and it kept all the nudity or the slight hints of nudity, but it took out all the four-letter words, and it was a little weird.
There aren't that many.
There aren't that many, but they were gone.
In fact, there are so few that it's a little startling when they show up. You're like, startling in a way that you're shocked. Yeah. You're just like, oh, they can cuss in this movie. Okay, well,
right, yeah,
fine.
Yeah. He tells his associates to be quiet when he's on the phone at one point and drops the F-bomb, and it's like it is legitimately startling at that moment. It's like, wait, this is a hard-boiled detective, and he's just saying that now. He must really mean it.
Yeah. Oh, Jack means business. We
exactly.
better shut up.
That's the contrast.
No Hayes commission to shut down that potty mouth.
So this film begins like every classic noir detective movie needs to begin, right? Which is a mysterious woman is waiting in the office of private investigator Jake Gittes.
Well, technically, it begins with some softcore porn pictures.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well,
right.
This is actually the thing I love about Chinatown.
Who is our protagonist? Oh, okay.
Chinatown announces itself because it has the credits, which are very 1930s, classic. Very 1940s, mm-hmm. very... Oh, we've gone down to the show to see a newsreel mm-hmm. and a cartoon, and oh, this new picture show called Chinatown, Johnny. And
but they're scrolling, which kind of breaks the
it does. The scrolling bit is out of place. But then you immediately smash cut to pictures of horrible things being done to a woman.
Uh-huh.
And or loving things, depending upon.
Or quite lovely, yes. Yeah. Depending.
Depending on your point of view. For Burt Young, it's not so lovely. But
I mean, she's married to Burt Young, yeah, so...
She's used to terrible things happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it does set the... This is the classic detective thing, which is being a detective is it's an ugly, dirty business, right? It's mm-hmm. not a respectable profession as much as they might want it to be. Because
as Jack Nicholson dresses, and he dresses very nicely.
I was going to say, he has quite the wardrobe for a... Mm-hmm. I think there's one case in which I went, oh yeah, that's a smarmy detective tie. But the other times, the other things you see him wearing are pretty stylish.
He charges $30 an hour.
$35.
Mm-hmm. Plus expenses. Oh yeah, that's it.
Plus 20 for his two ding-dong
associates.
Associates, yeah. And a bonus
Walsh
if he does his job.
That's right.
That's a pretty good deal. Pretty good deal.
Those are good rates. So, yes, but it does, after we find out that poor Burt Young is being made quite the cuckold, the true story begins with the lady waiting in Jack Nicholson's office to hire him to see if her husband is staying on the straight and narrow.
Right, right. And, of course, the twist here is that she, as it turns out, posing as the wife of the chief engineer of the L.A. Department of Water and Power, but she is not his wife. And this is all part of a larger setup, which is a nice twist on the classic, I believe my husband is having an affair. But in a part of the movie that I really liked is that right at the get-go here, like, who is this guy? Like, we saw those pictures. He's a detective. Okay, I get that. And she says, I want you to investigate my husband and find out if he's cheating on me. And his immediate reaction is, like, clearly that he has a checklist of all the ways he's going to try and talk her out of it. Like, you don't want to know. It's not going to help.
Let sleeping dogs lie.
and it's kind of interesting that you get the sensation that he doesn't give this checklist to Burt Young. It's only to the women.
Right. Exactly. That's quite obvious. It's like, I'm not going to take her seriously, because even if she's right, it's not a case I'm particularly interested in. I'm not interested in helping her in any way. Let's just get this out of my office. Even though later on he says matrimonial is a thing that he does. So it's like, wait, this is kind of your bread and butter, dude. I'd think you would just take this up.
I think, I don't know. I read it as being a tiny shred of humanity in him, which is, if we go down this path, because he's probably been through this so much.
It's giving him credit for
that.
You're
not going to give him credit for that? No. If we go down this path, it's going to be bad. And you already suspect him. So really, do you need to see it? Do you really need that?
She's like, little lady, why don't you just calm down? I think it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it.
I think
you look wealthy. You're fine.
Dames always go back to their husband. She'll never follow through with it.
I think it's a thing that he's trying to wrong foot her so that she's more inclined than ever to find out.
Oh,
but that's interesting. It's to build trust and build a rapport with your client.
It does establish his credibility.
Yeah. Exactly.
I feel like these are the weeder questions he asks every client. He's trying to determine whether there's really something here so he doesn't spend the next 2 weeks taking pictures of, you know, random people arguing outside the peach pit or the pig and whistle.
The pig and whistle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A place that does in fact exist.
Yeah.
All right. That's fair enough. The idea that he's, it definitely feels like he is going through a checklist, right?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He's done this a million times. He like starts this whole thing with, oh no.
Yeah, he's got that great line reading. I think my husband is being unfaithful. Oh no, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's got his checklist to go through.
To your point about this being famously well written, there's so much that we learn in this beginning. I mean, first we get Burt Young, who shows up later, of course, and we learn that Jake Giddes does. We know how he does it. We know what kind of person he is in just a minute or so. Mm-hmm. Really, it's very compact.
And we also get introduced really quickly to the stakes, because he goes immediately to the hearing on the dam that they're trying to build to bring water out from the valley into downtown Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And within the span of a minute, 90 seconds, we find out that Hollis Mulray, the head of the Water and Power Department, doesn't want to build the dam, but everyone else wants the dam because they want the water.
Yeah, it's quite a contentious public meeting, and it's funny because it's set up as being very much like, well, we got to decide, are we going to make this dam or are we not going to make this dam? That other dam, you know, but we got to make this dam. And then Mulray stands up and he goes, okay, the last dam collapsed, which is a true story, that there was a catastrophic dam failure that killed a lot of people. That's a true story. And he says, he essentially says, so I don't care if you decide to build the dam, I won't build it.
Well, he says it's not going to work, and for that reason, I'm not going to build it. He's speaking as an engineer.
He just says no.
And they aren't interested in the fact that it doesn't work. They're just like, you will build it or we're going to come and kill you or whatever.
Well, turns out, right?
Turns out.
Those are the stakes, right? Which is like powerful men say we're going to build a dam, and the engineer says it won't work, so we aren't going to build it. And the powerful men are like, oh, yes, Mr. Engineer, you're right. We're going to do what you say. Nope, that's not what happens.
No, that's never what happens.
Well, there are more powerful men elsewhere. Yes.
Dr. Drake, did you have engineer feelings while watching poor old Mulray?
I have more engineer feelings later on in the movie.
Okay.
Which I will bring up.
All right.
We have to talk about Rance Howard here.
Yes.
Making a wonderful
farmer is his
irate shepherd.
Name.
Irate Shepherd is what he, I have Angry Shepherd written down in my notes.
I believe he's credited as Irate Farmer.
Yeah, but he's the one who brings the sheep in, right?
Yeah, he's even got a crook.
Their names are Ron. Here's the thing I noticed. Their names are Ron and Clint, Drang.
Well, there's two celebrity dads in this movie, because not only is Rance Howard the father of Ron and Clint Howard in this movie, but there's a guy later where I paused it because I said, God, that guy looks like Crispin Glover. Oh, it's Crispin Glover's dad.
It's Bruce. Yeah.
So it happens a couple of times. It's amazing. Yes, good to see Rance Howard, who, you know, he was in stuff. He was in stuff. Now we just think of him as Ron Howard's dad. So what happens next, Phil?
Well, he starts trailing Mulray around, partially to find the girl. But it seems that what he's really doing is spending a lot of time going to the ocean, where there's mysterious runoffs in the middle of a drought. Hmm. That seems suspicious. But eventually, one of Giddes's ding-dong associates, as Steve said, calls and says, yay, we found him down by the lake. Again, water. Mm. And he's in the company of a young lady. And they're out for a little row. And and a roll.
That's very different.
And soon, Giddes
playing patty cake.
Giddes is in the boat after them, taking photos with Crispin Glover's dad.
Yeah, he's doing that thing you row, and he's like, "Oh, well, we're having a good time." Click, click, click. And all that.
I'm just taking photos of my friend in the boat.
Yep,
in the boat.
Totally. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Just two men enjoying each other in a boat.
Look,
wearing,
you know,
suits.
He works for the Department of Water and Power. He is obviously obsessed with water and probably power, too. Those are probably the things going on here, I think.
Yes. So the photographs are made, including of Mulray and the Chippy, as Giddes says at one point, at a love nest. And they find their way into the paper. There's a horrible scandal, and of course, Giddes gets the publicity that he that's so good for his business.
Isn't this the first sign that it's a setup too? Because the paper, it gets immediately put in the paper.
Immediately put in the paper,
very quickly.
Yeah.
And Jake is not sure how it got there. Is one of the things that we learn early on. He's all, I didn't give him to the paper, but hey, who cares? It all worked out well for me. But unfortunately, this is when we find out that his client was not Mrs. Mulray, because the real Mrs. Mulray, as played by Faye Dunaway, is waiting for him in the office with lawyers.
That is a good moment, right? It's like, well, who are you? I'm Mrs. Mulray.
Do you know who I am, Mr. Giddes? You've never seen me before.
Faye Dunaway.
Yeah.
Do you know who I am, Mr. Giddes?
Oh, I don't. What is the line? Oh, I don't get upset. I have lawyers to do that.
Yeah, I don't get tough with anyone.
Yes. Yeah. It's great. So obviously this is bad news for Jake, because it's not good for private detectives to get tricked. And so at this point, and now I'm trying to recall. Well,
he goes to Mulray's office.
He's going to he first goes to the office where he meets the assistant director of Water and Power.
Who's that guy? He meets
the butler cat.
Yeah.
played by an actor who I have a certain affection for. Yes, it's John Hillerman. It's using his real, genuine John Hillerman voice. Not an affected British accent.
Not his fake Higgins accent from Magnum PI. It's the actual John Hillerman, and he is the number two at the DWP, who's like,
for now.
Yeah, exactly.
And a good red herring, you know, should you need one at any point.
Yes. And happily condescending to another private investigator.
Yeah. Condescending bureaucrat.
And at this point, John Hillerman mostly played these kind of roles where it's like, I'm an officious jerk. And because he's also a corrupt sheriff in Paper Moon that came out about this time. And so I'm sure 1974 audiences are seeing John Hillerman and going, this guy's trouble.
It's a real William Atherton of his time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he suggests, since Jake is looking for Mulray, that he go down to one of the reservoirs where Mulray likes to take his lunch. And
as you do.
Yes. And unfortunately, Mulray is taking lunch there. Mm, a permanent lunch.
Forever.
A liquidy lunch.
Not the good kind of liquid lunch either.
That's right.
They're fishing him out of the reservoir where he's dead.
And it's another lovely line where it's like, you know, why are you here, Jake? I want to talk to Mulray. Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. You can try.
You can try.
This is also when we learn that Jake is a former police officer, because the lieutenant in charge of the case is, I believe, his old partner from their coppin days.
It's Lou.
Lou Escobar.
Right. Lou Escobar.
Yes.
From back when they were in Chinatown.
And the villainous Loach. Loach. Ooh, I hate that Loach.
Hovering over this is like, this Mulray guy, like, obsessed with water. He keeps going to the water sites. You know, what's the deal with all the water? And it's the murder weapon too. So,
I love the line, you know, water department guy drowns in the middle of a drought. Mm. How about that?
Only in California.
Oh, I love that corner. The coroner who is morbidly obese by today's standards. In 1974, people must have thought, oh my God, that guy's going to die on camera. And plus he's got a horrible
that
cough.
He really did sort of seem like he might fall onto one of his lab tables at any moment.
And I think they work it into the plot, because how you doing, Johnny? I'm great, Jake. Never better. Yeah.
Aren't all coroners like that, though?
Yes,
that's a
standard
thing.
I mean, I never
thing.
Thought of that as a coroner stereotype, but now I'm gonna.
Yeah. He looks like the kind of guy that would accidentally leave a hoagie inside a corpse.
Yes, exactly.
That CIA CSA emphysema spinoff, just not great.
And then work it into his report, like, he died by a hoagie. I've got to cover this up.
I think William Conrad could have played that part, David. What do you think?
Oh, in his sleep.
Sure.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So the engineer thing that struck me as very wrong here is when Jake goes to Mulray's house, and I think this is actually before he finds out that Mulray's dead, and there is this enormous house, a gigantic mansion with servants everywhere, and he's come to see Mulray, I think, and he ends up seeing Mrs. And you know, that an engineer who's that rich? No. And certainly a public engineer, you know, a municipal engineer. No, that's wrong. Now, we later learn why he was that rich. It's because he owned the water department somehow. He owned
which
all
is an
the
interesting construction, and they say it several times. He owned the water department.
Yeah. I don't know how that happened.
I think that was true in Los Angeles. I believe it was privately owned.
I think it is. I did read that, but it is. Yeah, it is kind of shocking.
This is a basically a 500-foot view of the life of, is it William Mulholland?
William Mulholland. It's about 30 years too late.
Yeah.
I mean, it actually happened in the early 20th century.
I mean, there's a lot of differences, and names were changed to protect the innocents. Obviously, you've got Mulray here instead of Mulholland, and oddly enough, Mulvihill as well, and I think I read somewhere that the two are like the dichotomy that make up Mulholland.
Thing.
I can't imagine how Mulvihill fits in with William Mulholland, but I didn't know the man, so... But yeah, I mean, they changed like the St. Francis Dam is the Vanderlip Dam in this and a variety of other things.
And then actually the St. Francis Dam thing, this was supposed to take place in 37, and that thing happened in 28, which ended Mulholland's career pretty much.
But yes, we should mention Mulvihill. He is basically the former sheriff of Ventura County, now working as a water department thug for
henchman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'll pop up at very inconvenient times for Jake Gittes throughout the movie.
He's such a mini boss. I love him.
Mm-hmm. I one of the things I love about this movie is it does not really, it does a little bit of exposition, but it basically leaves you to fill in the details. Mm-hmm. We can pretty much conclude that Jake and Mulvihill have a past because Jake is insulting them at the water and power building. What are you doing here? Did they turn off your water? How would you know? You don't drink it. You don't bathe. Oh, they wrote you a letter, but then you'd have to be able to read. And Mulvihill is getting steamed and steamed and ready to punch him until John Hillerman, bless his heart, stops the bloodshed. But anyhow, by this point, old foes become friends as Mrs. Mulray ends up hiring Jake for real to look into both the disappearance of the girl that Hollis was seeing and I guess his murder as well, since he's accompanying her to the autopsy or the identifying the body. By the way, our gasping for air coroner mentions that, yes, they pulled a great deal of salt water out of his lungs.
Right. Did not drown in the drinking water reservoir.
No.
He's been moved there from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another guy that was drowned also. He drowned in the LA River, which is essentially dry.
Mm-hmm.
How are all these things happening?
Where is all that water coming from?
That was very much one of those extra piece of information given by supporting character moments that I honestly, it's a cliche that I really enjoy, which is like, say, Jake, I got another guy here who died the same way. It's like, oh, really? Great. Tell me more. I wonder if these two deaths are related. They're related.
Well, and weirdly, it's the bridge that he has just seen Mulray go talk to the little Mexican boy on the horse as it turns out. So it's a pretty easy connection to make, but I don't think the saltwater thing comes out until later. I think it's a little too early for that reveal. But
right. Yeah. It's a little bit later.
And I think Lou tells him that eventually closer to the end. But yeah, that the reveal that there was another guy that drowned in 2 inches of water in the dry LA riverbed comes out here.
One of the things I like about this structure is it is a classic story of a guy who pulls on a thread that he doesn't understand he's pulling. And then the thread just keeps on unraveling, right? Like Jake is just going from, he's doing his legwork, right? But it, he's being diligent about it. But like you can see as an audience member, as it all just like the scope widens and it all starts to unravel, you're like, oh, he was murdered. It's the water. We get that moment with the real estate where it's like, well, he and this other guy basically own the water department and they're buying up all the land in the valley. And you know, it definitely feels like Jake is a good detective in the sense that he's going to doggedly pursue this case. But that if he looked up at any moment about halfway through, he'd be like, nope.
Right.
Nope. I'm out of here.
This stands up really nicely with some of the best of Chandler and Hammett, where it's very similar, right? It's this dirty little case that actually has larger stakes.
Yeah.
And that is one of the reasons I do think it's one of the best scripts, because it is so beautifully noir. It really hits those notes.
Well, and the hard thread for a movie like this to put through the needle is often the detective making the right guess at the right moment. And sometimes you see a detective doing something and you say, what motivated him to do that? Well, he had to do it for the plot to advance. And in most cases, there are a couple where I question it, but in most cases, Jake is just following the thread as it is spooled out, and he's not having to make giant leaps or, you know, he does a couple of deductive things as he goes along. But they're earned. They don't feel like it's too. And that's, I think, the mark of the screenplay as much as the quippy line. I mean, they're great quippy lines in there, but again, they're not overdone. And so the screenplay is deeper than just sort of the dialogue moments. It's actually the structure of how the mystery is unspooled and eventually solved.
And they do something here that I really appreciate as an audience member, which is that Jake will kind of figure something out and you can tell that like he's kind of put two and two together, but it doesn't reveal that to you at quite that moment. And you kind of figure maybe you've started to sort of put it together, but they leave it out there for a little while. They don't have him, you know, do a little voiceover or explain what he's thinking at that moment in time. It's just maybe like a 5 minutes later, he'll talk to another character in a very organic way and mention what he's pieced together. And so it doesn't like stick out like this, okay, this is the exposition now, but it also gives you a chance to kind of hang out there, try to figure it out. And then when it turns out it's right, it's like, yeah, okay, I get how that all fits together because I've been thinking about
David
it.
David can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in one draft there might have been some exposition.
Yeah, I think initially there was.
There was a narration. It was supposed to be narration.
Yeah.
And Polanski is the one who said, I want this to be in subjective present tense.
Right.
I don't want to be explaining this as if it already happened. Mm. And so we find out things as Jake finds them out. When right. Jake is knocked unconscious, we fade out until he wakes
right.
up.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it is a first-person movie.
Yeah.
Jake is everywhere, and we see what Jake sees.
Right. And it plays scrupulously fair with those setups and discoveries, but it doesn't telegraph. It doesn't, you know, when he's at the Mulray's house and he sees the gardener out on the pond and he's like, you know, oh, salt water, bad for grass. And, you know, that just goes by. That's just there. And he kind of looks, there's a thing in the pond, but then he gets distracted when she shows up and say, oh no, he comes back to that later. And we get little hints of that throughout. We don't even quite know what that was.
And I seem to recall, it's been years since I've seen it, but Two Jakes, the misbegotten sequel to this, does have narration to it.
Yes, it does.
And not much to its detriment.
It is one of the things that doesn't work about it in a long list.
It's weird because it's the same screenwriter. Nicholson directed that one. I've not seen it, but Robert Towne came back for it, which is sort of surprising that he did. I don't know where his career was at that time, but
he wanted to write. He was actually having a little bit of a renaissance then.
Right.
He wanted to do a trilogy, and the Two Jakes is what killed it. And the Two Jakes got delayed because Robert Evans was determined to play the other Jake. And they were all like, no.
Oh, Robert Evans. What a guy.
I want to talk a little more about the decision to make this first person. I think that's probably the best possible move they could have made here. Because this is, I mean, it's a mystery film. It's a suspense film. But in some ways, it almost borders on psychological horror. There's a palpable sense of dread for me when I watch this film.
Oh yeah.
I've only ever seen two Polanski films, this and Rosemary's Baby. And in both of those, the whole film feels like the whole deck is stacked against you and everyone around you is in on a joke that you don't know about. And I say you deliberately because the fact that they chose to film every scene from Gittes's perspective makes it feel really intimate. And it's really hard to watch this or Rosemary's Baby without getting this overwhelming sensation that you're just in the middle of a nightmare. And, you know, everything's about to fall down and you've stepped in it. You're way too deep and bad things are going to happen at any turn.
Well, it's clear that everyone is lying to him. And it's clear that, you know, of course, people are dropping dead. So, yeah, it's a dangerous situation for
him. And as he's following the thread, you know, we know as moviegoers, right? It's like, oh, no. Like, you know, he's still following the thread doggedly, but we know this is a movie. It's like, oh, God, no.
Right.
Like, you know, it's a horror movie. It's the same thing, right? Where it's like, we know more than him just enough to know that this is going a very bad direction.
No, Jake, don't go back to the reservoir at night. Don't do it.
and I mean, we'll get to the end, obviously. But one of the things I do like about this is that we, the audience, get to know the whole solution to everything. We get to understand it and we get that resolution. But it doesn't quite resolve the way you want a happy Private Eye movie to resolve.
Nope.
And that's, I love that.
Yeah, that's always going to be good.
Forget
but,
it, David.
But the beauty of that tension is that there's, just by nature of it being a noir, there's several minutes at a time of, you know, Jake driving behind Mrs. Mulray or Jake wandering around an abandoned reservoir. Mm-hmm. Scenes that in a 2-hour and 10 movie should make it feel interminably dull. And yet there's even through these scenes, there's just such a constant undercurrent of tension that this movie rushes by. It does not feel like a 2-hour, 10-minute movie. It feels like maybe half that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I wanted to talk about this. So this is the first time I've seen this movie. This is the premise of Old Movie Club, by the way. This is it in its rawest form. A famous movie everybody knows. And Phil says, hey, Jason, how about Chinatown? And I go, oh, I haven't seen it. Okay,
you
let's do it.
You are the Lex of Old Movie Club.
I am absolutely the Lex of Old Movie Club. So what do I know about Chinatown? I know two things about Chinatown. I know, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown.
Yep.
And I know.
Well, that's all you need to know.
And
that's
know.
That's pretty much it.
No, there's one other key thing, which is I know that Jack Nicholson's got a big bandage on his nose, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Which I always read as that his nose was broken. No, friends. No.
No.
And we've reached that point now where stupid old Mulvey Hill basically says, hey, nice nose you got there. Shame if anything happens to it.
And it's beautiful because it's not Mulvihill who does it.
It's Roman Polanski.
Where'd you get the dwarf, Mulvihill?
It's his thug, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Listed in the credits as Man with Knife.
Yeah.
But,
appropriate. I mean, they could have gone with Man with
the
boater
hat and
bow tie.
He also made a film called Knife in the Water earlier in his career, so they'll just take that for whatever it's worth.
So
he's
like
got
Jason,
a thing for knives and water.
Yep.
Like Jason, when I saw Chinatown back in high school, the only thing I knew, at some point something horrible happens to Jack Nicholson's nose.
Yes.
And here's the horrible thing. He's poking around the reservoir. He gets first nearly drowned in the steady release
of
water.
Mysterious water releases are happening during the drought. What is going on with that?
I used to have those in high school.
Yes, exactly. Speaking of high school.
Actually, that's a thing that happens as you get older. Anyway.
Old movie club.
Late at night, you gotta get up and go to the reservoir.
Fresh ruins his shoe. Oh, that's going to be the worst.
Florsheim shoe.
Going to be the worst thing that happens to him in this adventure, I think. His shoe getting ruined. No. Mulvihill grabs him, and there's Roman Polanski, Man with Knife. And Roman Polanski says, oh, you're a nosy little kitty cat, aren't you? You know what happens to nosy kitties? They lose their noses. And at this point, the knife has gone up Jack Nicholson's nostril. And with a flick of the wrist, the nostril is now ventilated. So
he does the linking rings trick, although in this case, it's not a very good trick. Because there's no hidden gap in the rings. Just goes straight through his nose. Yeah. But I have to say, I love the sheer audacity of taking your leading man. I mean, admittedly, this isn't Robert Mitchum here, but Jack Nicholson, he's not a bad guy. You hired
him
for a reason.
He's a handsome
man. That's right. I love the audacity of taking your leading man and making him walk around with a giant bandage in the middle of his face for almost half, if not more than that, of the movie. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And then even when you take it off, which is good, the evidence of the injury is still there. Mm-hmm. It's like, what happened to you? Oh, well, did you see me earlier in the movie? Because
it plays fair with it in a way that also a lot of movies would be like, oh, this guy got beat up. He's going to have bruises and black eyes and all that. And it's like,
and then suddenly he's Wolverine and healed up all completely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as quickly as that clothing he was wearing that was completely soaked in the last scene is now perfectly dry. Right.
Well, sure.
But this movie's like, nope, he's going to have a big bandage on his nose the whole movie. And so now I know that it was Roman Polanski as Man with Knife who did it.
Do we want to talk about Roman Polanski here and how terrible he is and whether we should feel guilty enjoying this movie made by a terrible man.
Then I would never watch another movie again.
Exactly. Well, that's sort of my point of view. I mean,
I mean, you can say at the time he was not yet as terrible as we know he is now.
As far as we know, I mean, it sounds like Faye Dunaway did not have a great time with him on set.
I think he was as awful. It's just hadn't been caught.
It wasn't. He was widely known as awful as he is.
Yeah.
Now, my wife, who, to be fair, doesn't really care for this movie to begin with, just won't be in the same room with me when I watch it. In part because Roman Polanski is terrible. She also feels that way about Woody Allen pictures. Won't watch.
I've gotten to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
Sure. And he's still alive, although he's 89.
Yes.
But his output, he still is working, but you know, he's been outside of the US. I would have a hard time, I wouldn't want to support his art on an ongoing basis because he is awful. But this is one of those things where I think it's the I don't know. I think it's worth at least mentioning that it is hard to separate from the art from the artist, he's not a great guy. I was listening to a different podcast a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about Woody Allen, and it was the Flophouse, and one of the Flophouse guys basically said, "Yeah, I'm basically waiting for him to die, and then I'll watch him again." And I thought, well, that's one way to do it.
And I mean, I look at this, and I look at the two Jakes, and it's not often that you can say, "All right, let's compare and contrast. Let's remove this person from the equation and see what it would be like." And whatever the alchemy is in this, the two Jakes does not have it.
Right. It was also 1990, and this is 1974.
A couple, a decade and a half on the odometer by that point for everyone involved. So,
well, and you're suffering from, even though it's not a sequel, even though it was intended as part of a trilogy all along, you're suffering from the fact that you have this incredibly successful thing that happened, and people come back together, as movie people often do. These people did a great thing before. Let's put them back together. That's no guarantee that it's going to be great again. So it may or may not have sucked if Polanski had directed it. There's no guarantee.
Having not seen it, I always thought that it suggested a lot that in the end Jack Nicholson directed it, because it's sort of like, who's going to do it?
You can't get a real director to do it.
Charming human being. He's not in the category of Polanski, but I don't have particularly warm feelings about Jack Nicholson as a human.
I just mean that it felt very much like it was his vehicle, and he couldn't find anybody to direct it for him. So he's like, all right, I guess I'll do it. And so then he did it. But that is how I always read that, is that it was either ego or it was like, literally, I can't make this movie any other way, so I have to direct it myself.
Originally, Robert Towne was supposed to direct it.
Right. Mm-hmm. The screenwriter.
And they had something of a falling out after. Mm.
Horrible after falling that. Out.
I haven't seen The Two Jakes either, but I would say that a large part of this film's appeal is, I think, that it was made in the middle of the 70s. Yeah. There's that seediness that sort of inundates this film that I don't think you get in any other decade, and certainly not in 1990.
Well, you're at peak Nicholson at this point.
That too.
And you're at peak Dunaway too.
From the noir point of view, this is not a period when noir was yet being celebrated. I mean, we're only 30 years out or 35 from the sort of peak of film noir, but this is by no means people going, you know what we need is more film noir. That happens in toward the 80s. And so
you're 33 years out from the Maltese Falcon.
Right. And this is an unusual kind of film, not only because it's, and I think it wears its periodness lightly, even though there's so much visual indication of its age. It's not trying to copy, I mean, the whole narration thing we were talking about before, there's a lot of narration in old noir, which is fine in some and not fine in others. And I think if there had been a narration track in this movie, it would have felt a lot more like it was copying that old style than just taking a lot of the sort of bones of what makes noir noir and putting it in a 70s construct, because the cynicism, especially the ending, is very, very 70s. It's very much not like late 40s noir.
Now, maybe Phil will have to tell me if I'm reading too much into this or not, but given some of his past selections for Old Movie Club, and I'm specifically thinking of The Long Goodbye from 1973, I have a theory, which I sort of subscribe to at least a little bit here, which is what this movie has and what The Long Goodbye has a little bit is you take your 70s movie, right? Which is, like I've said on many occasions, you know, you can't smell it, but you know it's smelly.
Yeah. Yes.
And you know what the color, you know, that earth tone color palette, and you know what a 70s movie is. And you say, we're going to make a 70s noir movie. And it's an interesting combination. And that's, and then I felt that way about The Long Goodbye, and I feel that way about this. It's like, Shelley, I agree completely. It is very much noticeable that it's a 70s movie while also being a noir movie. And there aren't 1,000 70s noir movies, right? There aren't, that didn't happen a lot. But when you get one like this, you can potentially get that kind of magic mixture of the fact that it, like, it feels really like a noir movie, but also Jack Nicholson is in it, and it's probably very smelly, and that worked for me. So Phil, is that have we found your sweet spot here, the 70s noir?
Yes, I am a big fan of shaggy detective 1970s movies. Those two that you mentioned, The Late Show is another favorite of mine.
Oh yes,
Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 even is a little bit like
Pelham
that, right?
1-2-3 well, is a little bit like that.
It's shaggy and it's
and smelly.
I even have a soft spot for Family Plot, the last Hitchcock movie.
Oh wow!
Where you have Bruce Dern basically running around being a dirtbag detective with his stupid pipe. And I have a soft spot for those kind of movies.
All right.
Some are better than others.
It's a perfect combo. I mean, the noir, the setting and what's going on in the plot is generally pretty seedy business, right? And the detective's usually a bit of a ne'er-do-well, a bit of a scumbag. And I think when they hit the 1970s, the feel of the 70s, I think, is a perfect fit for what it would really be like in the noir.
Right.
It was time.
Yeah, exactly.
It was time to bring it back. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in this movie, unlike The Long Goodbye, you know, where it is set in the 70s.
Right.
And there's a lot of 70s stuff going on in it, right? The Girls Next Door,
the girls
and all
next
that
door
sort of stuff.
The cat.
Sure. Here, yeah,
Arnold Schwarzenegger is a weird bodybuilder.
They didn't have cats in the 40s, you see. So it's a giveaway.
No, they were invented with Morris. Here, it just seeps in. Because it was what was around when they're making it, and that sort of style just kind of comes in without them having to write it in. It's just there.
It feels right.
Just it does feel right. That was right. What I was going to say. That's why I say it wears the period lightly. It neither goes back nostalgically to 1937, nor does it say we're the 70s and we're going to have like everybody with, you know, mod hair or some sort of indication that we're in the 70s. You can tell you're in the 70s if you've watched enough movies, but it feels like it wears both those periods lightly enough that it isn't a distraction.
And there's a cynicism to it that is more in the prose of Hammett and Chandler that didn't get into the movies in the 30s and 40s because they had the production code.
Because
they
the
couldn't
code,
go
yeah.
as far as the books and the mm-hmm. stories. And this feels closer in spirit to those than their own adaptations.
It does, but what's interesting is if you look at the style of the writing of the screenplay, and I said before, there are those quippy lines, but this is not a rat-a-tat-tat kind of movie, the way a lot of the noir, there was a sort of an affectation and a stylishness about noir that was very sort of put on. And you know, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler did a lot of that. But this movie doesn't have that feel, and so it feels more authentic and less of a sort of a nostalgia trip than it otherwise would have.
Nick Nicholson doesn't do rat-a-tat-tat. Just he talks too slowly.
That's true.
He can't do that. That's not his thing. It's not his thing. So in this next segment of the movie, and we don't have to go bullet point, but I wanted to mention we have Ida Sessions, mm-hmm. who is that the woman who was.
This was the Ida Sessions is the woman who pretended to be Mrs. Mulray.
The fake Mrs. Mulray.
Diane Ladd.
And she gives I love Diane Ladd. She gives him the tip that this is a real estate deal where basically they're rounding up the soon to be very valuable land in the San Fernando Valley, and which sends him to the retirement home for an amusing scene.
There's a few stops before there. First, there's the amusing scene at the records department with the little weasel man.
Oh, yes. Right.
With John Siracusa.
I have a hot take on that. I don't think he's that weaselly. I think Jake is really impatient, and perhaps he has a right to be, but I think Weasel Man is just doing his job. He's a records clerk, for God's sake.
Can I take this record out of the Hall of Records? Sir, this is the Hall of Records.
This is not a lending library.
This is where the records live. And so he tears it, and he rips out the page, which that was a nice moment where, you know, 10 seconds before it happens, I'm like, I see where this is going.
Yes, I need the a ruler. Why do you need a ruler? To see better?
I need to measure the length of this record.
Yeah, but basically that scene exists so that we know that land is being transferred at an astonishing clip.
It's his legwork that he's doing, so it shows us the legwork.
And we get to see giant shelves full of ledgers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this is the beginning of what I like to call the segment Jake Gittes's no good terrible day.
Oh, it's a bad day.
Yeah,
so much stuff happens in one day, which we find out much later. It's like, really, all of that happened in one day?
Uh-huh. Because first he heads on down to what I guess is Catalina. It was certainly seems to be a film there. Or
yes,
Malibu,
he gets off the boat at the Catalina Island Tuna Club.
Uh-huh.
Which is referred to as the Albacore Club here, but that is legitimately the Catalina Island Tuna Club.
Ah.
Still looks exactly like that. He gets, you can tell because he gets out in front of the casino, which is a very famous landmark on Catalina Island. He gets in a car out front, and he is driven to a place that looks nothing like Catalina Island in any way, shape, or form.
Not at all.
And a little bit later, he asks John Huston to come to Mrs. Mulray's house, and he says he can be there in an hour. So I'm pretty certain that's intended to be somewhere in Southern California by the beach, but not necessarily Catalina Island.
Not Catalina, sure.
Because it would take a very long time.
Right.
Well, this is our introduction to John Huston, who plays Noah Cross, former business partner of Hollis Mulray, mm-hmm. and father of Evelyn Mulray, the client and the wife of the dead dude. So that's convenient. Anyhow, he is super creepy.
Oh, I've never had a character make my skin crawl more than John
Huston. There
is
not a moment where you're watching John Huston in this movie and you think, he's probably okay. Just a little eccentric.
And what does he call Gittes? Gits? Mr. Gittes?
Gits.
Mr. Gittes.
The whole time.
At one point, he's corrected and he says Gittes, so you know he heard it, but he continues to call him Gittes after
does,
that.
He gets, that's the only time he says it. Yeah. He's corrected two or three times, but...
I'm always tickled by the scene where he asks, are you sleeping with my daughter? Because at the time, Jack Nicholson sure was with Angelica. And that gives me a little hee-hee.
Oh, man. But that line, he's asking about Mrs. Mulray, which is, of course, his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing what we know later when he asks, are you sleeping with her? And he's got this leer on his face.
Yeah.
It literally makes me want to vomit. It's so vile.
He's pretty terrible.
And within about a minute and a half of meeting him, we do have another one of those little Chekhov moments where he's like, let me show you this list. And he pulls out glasses. And he has to look carefully through the glasses. He goes, I don't know these names.
Very
nicely done.
I, in addition to what we learn about his character and his history with his daughter, which is terrible. I was reading it as, it's his business partner who marries his daughter.
Yes.
So leaving aside, which, you know, you can't really, but like just for a moment, that he raped his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
He also apparently passed his daughter on to his business partner.
Or his business partner
rescued her.
Right, which is
the way
Evelyn explains it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I lean to the side of him rescuing her. That's the way she interprets it.
It's
and they go off to Mexico.
At least to me, that they're not even intimate because they're talking about how, you know, he's cheating
and
she's sleeping with a bunch of guys.
He would also be much older than her, one would think.
That was sort of my point, is that the whole thing just screams unpleasantness, right? Because the revelation about John Huston, but just the fundamental, like, well, wait a second, he's your business, and he was married to... you know, right? It's like, oh, ooh, you know, right? Like that doesn't add up.
It's skeevy from the outside, but I really feel like the marriage is intended to be just for the look of the thing.
And he's saving her, and it's a rift between them because he's decided to get her out of there.
Yeah. Right. And the nice thing, like a lot of 70s movies, they leave it up to you, really, to decide, you know, how do I interpret this? All those interpretations work.
Yeah, because there's zero scenes in which they're together. The only time we see him alive, he's at that meeting. And so there's a lot of interpretation.
Or he's wandering the reservoirs of LA County.
There's
his
that.
True love, water.
But one thing I will say for John Huston, you should serve the fish with the head on it. But
nice tense scene, by the way, that whole thing of like, the surf and the fish. Ugh.
It's not just designed to let the two of them fight. It is also designed to distract you from the glasses moment.
The feeling there is I could have you killed at any moment. And that's very unnerving.
And it's one of those nice noir moments that has absolutely no noir lighting at all. It's very bright. You're outside in the sunlight. You're in a beautiful scene. You're having a nice lunch together. But it's terrifying.
That's what LA noir is all about, right? Is some of the most terrifying stuff happens in the bright sunlight of LA. It doesn't actually help any of the seediness go away. I also I feel like, and this is in hindsight, like it's also a moment where it's like, oh, here we go. It's John Huston and Jack Nicholson going against each other in this moment. Like it has that feeling too to me of this isn't just a confrontation, it's a classic confrontation of these two kind of legendary actors.
Well, it's a callback to film noir from the very beginning with John Huston.
There's so many great little moments where Jake drops something that indicates he knows more than he probably should. And the look that crosses John Huston's face in those moments is just beautiful. It's like, oh.
I was talking before we started, I was talking with Lauren about it because she watched this movie with me. And what she said, I was thinking about Chinatown today. I'm like, okay, where's this going? And she said,
I forgot.
She said, all of these things that like, there are many bad decisions that Jack Nicholson makes or questionable decisions. And I said, well, yeah, but I think he's making bad decisions. And she says, yeah, well, that's my point. It's not that it's a flaw in the movie. It's that it is that flaw in the character, that he does some stuff where you're like, oh, if only you were a better detective.
Well, it's the whole theme.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the whole story behind that, you know, when he was working in Chinatown, he was generally told by the district attorney to do as little as possible. And it's because there are so many different threads, you know, different gangs and factions in Chinatown, that you could very easily make an attempt to do something good and end up getting somebody killed, which it's strongly suggested is exactly what happened to him with a woman in Chinatown. And that's why he left the police force. And there's a moment later where he's in bed with Mrs. Mulray and he's discussing this. And he says all these things and it's just pure foreshadowing. It's like, I was trying to keep someone from being hurt and I ended up making sure that she was hurt. And you can't always tell what's going on. Like with you is another thing that he says.
And they don't tell you what the ultimate outcome of that story is. And I don't think they need to. The only hesitation I have about the whole Chinatown backstory thing is it's sort of, to me, it feels a little bit racist in the sense of saying, oh, we white cops, we can't possibly understand what's going on in Chinatown. Well, probably because you're terrible at policing in that area, for one thing, and you don't have any Chinese cops. Okay, I'll just chill out and watch the movie.
You're literally the LAPD.
But I think that statement to do as little as possible actually came from a discussion that somebody who made the film had with somebody who did police work in Chinatown. I mean, it's very
that
complicated.
That doesn't mean my point isn't right.
No, it doesn't.
No, it could just be because of incompetence or racism or whatever, or you know, but for whatever reason, it's very complicated and. The reason you don't have to hear more about what happened in the past in Chinatown is because that exact same thing is what's playing out right before you here. And the amazing thing here is that in the moment, while you're watching what Jake's up to, at least to me, it doesn't seem like he's making bad decisions. I mean, there are places where you're like, Jake, you're kind of pushing it there. You're getting a little too close to John Huston. But the threads that he's following and the decision that he's making for the most part seem like the right thing to do.
And then in hindsight, you're like, oh,
You set it in motion.
with the story that he tells about his past and with the story we're watching now. And, you know, everything is leading up to the line. You know, we make fun of it, but forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown. That's just the way it is. And, you know, several times ago, I started noticing all these moments in the movie where forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown would be a fitting line. It's just, yeah. That's just the way it goes. Right.
Yep, they save it.
It's the way the ball bounces.
So I should make one other plot note before we leave John Huston for a bit. He hires Gittes to find the girl, Mr. Gittes, and he sure seems interested in that girl that Hollis was hanging out with. Find probably nothing to it.
Wonder why.
I just want to know that she's safe, Mr. Gittes.
Anyhow, mm-hmm. we go to the San Fernando Valley, where the water department has told Jake that all those the water runoffs are, well, we're diverting some water to the valley to help the farmers there. That's news to the farmers, who are quite angry.
Orange groves at seeing
Jake, and basically we have car versus horse race through the orange groves.
Very exciting.
Such a great sequence. I love the drive down the long row of orange groves, mm-hmm. and then the sudden emergence of a man on horseback at the end of it.
With a rifle.
Right. Followed by the mad reverse down the same row. Mm-hmm. And then a random flock of geese scatters in front of his car that for some reason is just chilling amongst the orange groves.
Well, you know, normally orange groves are pretty chill places to hang out.
Ah, it's just great.
They're certainly undisturbed by water as of late.
And now this is the thing I hadn't noticed until this time around, because I hadn't read all about the history of Disney and stuff. This is basically how Disney accumulated the land for Disneyland.
Yeah.
Was going in and buying up all the orange groves and the orange farmers in a place that nobody wanted to be.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's now very clear this is a real estate / water supply scam that is going on here.
So after the farmers kick the living crud out of Jake,
and then
politely call his employee, since he has Mrs. Mulray's card in his pocket, mm-hmm. after they, beat him senseless, they go, well, we should call someone to retrieve him.
Yep.
I guess.
Well, in fairness to the farmers, he did call them dumb Okies.
He did. That was kind of a mistake, right?
Yes. So now she's in on the no good, terrible day. They go to a rest home in Mar Vista, which is where all the landowners in the San Fernando Valley are being parked until they shuffle off this mortal coil and their holdings can be transferred to presumably the evil forces behind this scheme.
Some of them are already dead.
Yes, exactly.
But still buying land.
Just prior to buying land.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, they're really good at speculation.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. There's a some nice comic moments where Jake is pretending to put his dad in the Raisin Ranch and poking around, and it works great until it doesn't, because Mulvihill is there with his little knife wielding dwarf friend, and suddenly Jake has to do an escape as they're firing guns at him, and this is the point where Faye Dunaway says what we're all thinking. Is this a normal day for you? Because this seems excessive. This is where we get a little bit of the limited backstory that the movie gives us, where Jake talks about his time in Chinatown and do as little as possible. Don't get involved. Oh, I tried to help someone once and I made it worse somehow. That's all we get. That's our insight into... into Jake.
And this is where they tip over into sleeping together. And just for the record, a seduction pro tip. When making an overture to a woman, mm-hmm. try exposing your festering open nose wound. They love it.
Chicks love it.
No, two steps, Steve. You're leaving out the steps of the pickup artist. One, show her your open wound. Two, uh-huh. comment on her weird eye.
don't forget the classic pickup line. Do you have any peroxide?
I'm just saying, I did all of these things and she still married me.
Oh, well then. Okay. But suddenly, after their post-coitus moment of of character exposition, suddenly Mrs. Mulray gets a call and has to leave.
Suspicious.
And she says, "Hey, Jake, don't follow me," she says to the detective.
Detective.
Whose entire
career... It has
career,
nothing to do with what we've been talking about this entire movie.
Who
don't
has
follow
just been,
me.
Who has just been saying, "What's your deal, lady?"
Right. Yeah. "No, I got an urgent call. It's nothing. Don't worry. It's not. I gotta go. It's nothing. Gotta go now, right? It's very important.
Has nothing to do with any of this. Mm-hmm. No, it's all good.
It's not a guy.
No. Well, it is. It's James Hong, everyone. It's
James
the
Hong.
I love James Hong.
It's the butler, and she's driven to his house where we see the girl being kept against her will. Who knows? Through a window, it's hard to say, but Jake naturally assumes that he's again being played for a sucker, not for the first time in this movie.
Right. Well, I mean, she is screaming and crying, and she is mm-hmm. drugged seemingly yes. against her will, at least initially. Mm-hmm. So it's not the worst deduction that you could make given the situation and mm-hmm. how little you actually know about Mrs. Mulray.
So at this point, Gittes confronts Faye Dunaway, uh-huh. confronts Mrs. Mulray, and she says, "Oh, don't. Yes, this is the girl that Hollis was catting around with, but it's okay. She's my sister. She's my sister. It's okay. Oh, okay. I'll buy that. I'm gonna go home
for
now."
A minute there, I thought things were weird, but now that I know she's your sister, everything's okay.
So, yeah. So it turns out there's a third thing I knew about Chinatown, but I didn't know it was from Chinatown, and it's my sister and my daughter.
Well, the cops have to get involved before that, but yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jake uses his incredible interrogation techniques, which we all want to emulate as good detectives, slapping people
yeah.
around.
Well, again, this is later, because first he has to go home. He gets lured to Ida.
We got two things here. One is she's my sister, which, of course, is halfway there mm-hmm. to where we want to go. But also, at some point while they're in the car, she drops her head onto the steering wheel and sets off the horn, yeah. which is also something that comes back at the end of the movie.
Yes.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I've never noticed that before. Oh. Thank you. Thank you for... I actually did not ever...
It's loud.
Do the one-to-one connection.
Yeah,
nor did I. I noticed it when it happened, but I didn't connect the two. You, mm-hmm. That's a good point.
By the way, there are also a lot of albacore on various people's walls in the movie that I noticed for the first time. Is that John Hillerman's got just a random picture of a tuna on the wall.
The thing I noticed this time is in the opening when Burt Young is leaving the office, he's muttering stuff about catching skipjack,
yeah, because yeah. he's a fisherman,
and I said, "Oh, hey, albacore, that's going to come up again several back, yeah. times."
It's Chekhov's albacore.
Mm-hmm. Or apple core, depending on who you talk
yeah.
to.
At what point in the movie you are. Mm. Yeah.
So it's time to catch up with Ida Sessions. Jake is lured to her house to find out how she's doing. She's quite dead is the answer.
You can try.
Like everyone that Jake is involved with.
Yeah, she's been cut up. And good, Escobar and Loach are there. And this is when Jake probably makes one of his first of significantly dumb moves to the denouement. He tries to there's a big thing going on where the Department of Water and Power is letting off all this water, and they're bleeding the valley dry so they can buy it at cut rate prices. And they go to John Hillerman, and John Hillerman says, "No, that's not what's happening at all. He's a crazy man." And who do you think the cops are going to believe? Respectable John Hillerman or crazy slash face Jack Nicholson?
Even though the cop, of course, was a friend and perhaps partner of Jack Nicholson.
I think that's especially why he doesn't.
Maybe. That's
it.
Yes.
Jack
yeah.
Nicholson,
yes.
You're an idiot. I don't believe anything you say. I know you personally.
So then we get your classic shady detective move where, okay, fine. I'll bring in Mrs. Mulray. Let's drive down to San Pedro. She's hanging out there. Hey, let me go in alone, and I'll bring her out to you. And by this point, we realize that this is Burt Young's house. Hey, Burt Young. Chekhov's Burt Young.
Yeah.
Appears in the movie. And basically, this has all been a ruse to allow Jack Nicholson to shake the cops.
Right. But before we do that, of course, we get to meet Burt Young's wife. Who's got who's got a black eye, and bruises.
Got a mouse under her eye.
By the way, he's wearing what I believe is colloquially called a wife beater.
Imagine that.
Anyway, they escape out the back.
But he's a good guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Actually, I really like that detail, right? Because he could be a good guy. And the movie's like, he's not.
Yeah.
He's not.
Yeah. But before we get to Burt Young's house, we have Shelley's thing.
Because that's right.
Jake goes back to Mulray's house.
This is a very complicated plot.
It really is.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot. There's a more plot than you can shake a stick at in here or a knife. But this is where we get Saltwater's very bad for the glass.
Mm-hmm. My sister, my daughter.
Yes, because first Jake goes to the Mulray mansion and finds that it's being packed up because Evelyn's skipping town.
She's leaving town, yeah.
And this is where we have the big reveal that, hey, that little pond in the backyard of the Mulray house, that has salt water in it.
Yeah, he connects it. It's like very bad for the grass.
And that's when he remembers that he saw this the thing. And yeah, he pulls out the glasses and he goes, maybe Mulray and his glasses.
And this is where he got
assumes. And I like the gardener in that scene is completely willing to just submerge himself almost up to his hips in that water in order to reach for it.
He is a professional, and he's got the hip waders. All he cares about is the grass, Shelley. Just wants that grass.
The man has got one obsession, and it's the grass.
His client is not the Mulrays; it's the grass.
It turns out that it's not just a racist caricature, because that pond is also bad for the glass. Yeah,
bad for glasses,
which is the joke I made at the beginning of the show.
Yes. Thank you, Shelley.
You're welcome.
So Jake goes to confront Evelyn at James Hong's house. And don't give me that crap that she's your sister. Well, she's my daughter. And this is the very famous scene where Jack Nicholson slaps her from pillar to post while she alternates between she's my sister, she's my daughter, she's my sister, and my daughter. So this is where the full reveal of the horrible things that John Huston has done to his daughter are brought out into the open.
And also, by the way, those aren't my husband's glasses.
Right.
Because he didn't wear bifocals.
Yeah. Oh.
Because Jake has basically accused her of killing the husband before all this reveal goes on. And she's like, well, no, I can prove I didn't. They're not his glasses. And then he immediately switches tacks and starts slapping her around.
Right. But at this point, he's also already called the cops over to the house.
Yes.
So he's set into motion.
Which is a little bit of a problem. But
the badness that's about to proceed from here.
Yes, this is when we do the side quest to Burt Young's house. And we lose the cops. And Burt Young is going to meet up with Evelyn and her sister-daughter and ferry them down to Mexico on his boat. And that's going to be our big escape plot. Mm-hmm. Let's see if it works out. First, let's go confront Noah Cross back at the Mulray Mansion.
Yes, yes. So remember earlier when I said that that he makes some questionable decisions?
Yeah,
this is a good one,
this
right?
Would be one of
which
them.
Is like, hey, powerful rich guy, why don't you just come over? And surely I've got this all under control, and
feel free to bring a henchman.
Yeah, not like bring in my cops buddies at this point because I figured something out. No, I'm gonna do it all on my own. It'll be fine.
Well, that's one of the nice things that I noticed this time is his car pulls up. And he's immediately there at the doorway and he's coming in. And all I could think was, oh, of course, because you're not parking the car. Mm. There's someone else.
To some extent, I think this very, very dumb move may be partly just to get Noah Cross out of the way so that Evelyn can escape with the daughter. Mm. Occupy him. I think he's less concerned about his personal safety than that at this point, because let's be frank,
clearly
he's the reason that they can't just drive away. So this is either just genuinely the dumbest thing you could possibly do, or it's marginally heroic. It's hard to say which.
Mm-hmm. I also think he wants to stick it to Cross personally. He doesn't want to leave it to the cops.
Oh,
he doesn't want to just be like, here, it's like, no, I figured out you did it.
Yes, but I have my thugs here, so...
Yeah.
Wonderful scene, though, between Nicholson and Huston, where we sort of get the plot basically being, yes, I am, I, I, I have a vision, and my vision is a giant city.
The future.
The future, Mr. Gitz. They're going to... They're basically going to, we're going to build L.A. It's a stupid desert. No one can live here. We're going to spit in God's eye and take all this water and allow people to live. Bring the city to the water is what they say. Mm-hmm. But yes, I also have Mulvihill here, and he's got a gun. And you don't.
Take us to the girl.
Really, Jake, a detective of your age and experience, you probably should have thought of that. Oh, yeah. Well.
And finally, 2 hours into a movie called Chinatown, we get to go to Chinatown. Because that's where Evelyn Mulray is hiding out and being picked up by Burt Young, and they're going to escape. Except, sorry, folks, the cops have gotten there and arrested Jake's associates. And Noah Cross is now there with Mulvihill, and everyone is there on the streets of Chinatown, fussing and a-feudin', and Jake's trying to explain it all to Escobar. And
it's it's a beautiful thing that gets set up where Jake says, you know, if I don't show up at X time to his partners, you go and wait for me in Chinatown. And clearly the reason the cops are there is because they followed the partners. They were smart enough to follow the leg men.
Mm-hmm. And
we get nice creepy scene where John Huston introduces himself to the sister daughter.
Oh, yeah.
I'm your grandfather. Yeah.
And it just keeps getting creepier and creepier.
And he's got, I did not know that John Huston had like plant man hands where they're like tentacles that he's using.
They're amazing.
Lord. Oh, that's, it's just horrible. Anyhow, Evelyn decides that this is not going to work out in her favor at all because her father owns the cops. He owns everything. So she, shoots John Huston, manages to only wing him. How could you miss? You're standing
that close.
Yeah.
He's wearing like a white vest. It's easy to see him. I mean,
yeah. She gets him in the shoulder and he goes, "Oh, that tickled." Oh. And she drives away with the daughter, but unfortunately, Lieutenant Escobar is a much better shot than she is.
I think Loach is the one who ends up.
Oh, that's
right. Loach. It's Loach.
That's right, cuz Escobar shoots in the air and Jake tries to tackle him and then it's stupid Loach. Oh, I hate Loach. And he's a very good shot.
Good name.
Yep. And shoot your eye out, kid.
Yeah. Yes. Spoiler alert, he shoots her eye out.
Spoiler alert for a scene that happens 20 seconds from now, so I hope you're not saddened when you get there.
Oh, no, we didn't tell them to pause and then press play.
And then she falls and triggers the spoiler
horn.
It's
the thing which I've now been told has been foreshadowed. What an idiot I've been for the past 40 years. But not for that reason. Anyhow,
so she's dead. She's dead. He's gotten her killed.
You know who's not coming back in The Two Jakes is Faye Dunaway.
She has a voice cameo in it.
She does, but she's
not there.
No, she doesn't appear on camera.
No.
And of course, who manages to spirit away with the daughter? Why, it's Noah Cross. Yeah. So I have... a happy family ending.
I have seen a lot of really nasty things in movies over the years as a big horror movie fan.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, the sight of John Huston absconding with his daughter / granddaughter while he shushes her and stifles her screams and makes little cooing noises at her.
And covers her eyes. Yeah.
Because
very
remember
dramatically.
That she's not just screaming because this strange man has grabbed her. She's just seen her sister mother killed.
But she doesn't know what's coming. But it's
terrifying. And it's that there was actually this Polanski wanted that ending. Robert Town didn't want that ending. He wanted it to end more happily. And that was why fell out. At the
Well,
time
maybe this
the
was
movie.
The happy ending from Polanski's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But this is legitimately one of the most haunting things I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
It's
terrible
bad.
in a good for the story sense, but. Terrible.
Yeah,
I think it was
right as an ending, but you're watching it and it's just awful.
And it is easily the creepiest ending I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
To this day.
And which is when we get the famous line, "Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown," from one of the Ding Dong associates. And better words have never been said. Try to forget that, buddy.
I'm never 100% clear here whether Lou is somewhat in on what's going on here or whether he's just, you know, inept. He does just let John Huston take the daughter off, you know, somewhere, which seems like a bad thing. But I think him sending away Jake at this point is like he foresees that he might go berserk and go on a killing spree at this point.
Well, he says, I'm doing you a favor, Jake. Go.
Whether that's I'm doing you a favor because I know what's going on here and you don't want to be in this
Escobar
any deeper.
I think Escobar has not risen to the position of a lieutenant in the Los Angeles Police Department by being scrupulous about wrapping up all the loose ends. I think he knows
especially
when to
Noah
cut
Cross.
his
like
losses.
Right now, as far as he knows, as far as he needs for his report, Evelyn Mulray was the killer.
Sure.
They got her.
Yep.
Done. But,
and if he gets Jake out of there immediately, then Jake is basically free and clear.
Right.
That's right.
You know.
Right. I'm going to sweep this all under the rug, so you should not be by the rug when I do that. Right. Just get out of here.
One of the things we toyed with was doing this as a double feature with LA Confidential, but then we didn't want a 6-hour podcast.
No.
So, yeah.
But it is very much the here are the cops, they're going to fix it. It's not going to be the truth, but it's going to be neat and pat and done.
Well, because John Huston is the most powerful man in Los Angeles.
That's right.
He's going to get what he wants. Right.
There's your sequel to Jake's. Not you. You're terrible. Go to LA Confidential.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, I would love to talk LA Confidential.
LA Confidential, that's about right.
It's not old enough.
No, we have to wait.
Give it another 10 years.
We have to wait about 10 more years.
It is like a last century movie club, so it's almost there.
25? 20, it's almost 5 years ago, something like that.
97.
Oy.
Yeah.
And that's Chinatown, everybody. Fun for the entire
da,
family.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah, Chinatown. Woo!
That was the original ending line where all the actors turned to the camera and went, Chinatown!
With jazz hands. Yep.
I did have a Simpsons moment about halfway through when I said to myself, when are they going to get to Chinatown? But they got to Chinatown.
Again, Jason, this is what I said as a teenager. I said, this movie doesn't have a lot of Chinatown
no.
in it.
No, but it does. It's just more of a metaphorical Chinatown.
It's not the quantity, it's the quality.
I mean, plenty of town. Yeah. And there's a fair smattering of China,
Robert
but not Town. So much Chinatown.
That's right.
It's all Robert Town, 100% town.
There's even actual China in that fish scene, the lunch scene.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, Chinatown.
Good.
How did everybody feel about it?
Well, I love it.
It is legitimately a great movie. It does what it says on the box, and it is its own unique thing. It does show you Chinatown.
I was going to say, it barely shows. It does what it says on the box. That doesn't matter to me. But
it is literally this weird hybrid of 40s and 70s. There's not a lot of those, and the others don't work. This is the one, right? And it's so good.
It's very good. And as I said before, I think what really makes it work in that way is that you can see the 70s and you can see the 40s, but it is neither nostalgic nor hyper modernist. And there's the score, which we haven't talked about, is really wonderful.
Jerry Goldsmith
and understated. There's so much understatedness.
Second choice for the score. I forget who was going to do it originally, but it didn't work. So they said, Jerry Goldsmith, you do it.
They picked the right person. And it's just, it's none of it's overdone. I mean, even Jack Nicholson, who can ham it up. And I am not a Jack Nicholson fan, and I don't think he's a handsome man. Sorry. However, he's good in this movie. I don't think he's transcendent.
What do you think
of
the festering nose wound?
Well, I try not to, but yes.
That's even better.
That's acting
and,
right
and
there.
And I mean, I will say, I'm not a fan of Jack Nicholson, and I'm not a fan of Faye Dunaway, and I like them in this. There are films that I like him in. I'm just not a fan of him.
Awkwardly, my closing note was going to be, we forget how really good an actor Jack Nicholson is.
Yeah,
because
he is.
From Batman on, it'd be, wait till they get a load of me. And then they sort of hamming it up. From
Jack Nicholson for his entire career has basically just played Jack Nicholson. So he's gotten very good at it.
I don't know. Drang mentioned in the 70s, he was on a roll because he did this. He did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There's King of Marvin Gardens. There's Five Easy Pieces.
Five Easy Pieces. Yeah.
Okay.
There's
some great things in there.
I mentioned on Magnum Podcast a couple episodes back, I just watched Missouri Breaks, a terrible movie that he's very good in.
Yes.
He's very good in that.
He's the 70s actor.
He's not the problem.
If you have to choose one, it's him. I mean, yes, there's Warren Beatty. Yes, there's Gene Hackman. But at the top has got to be Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how many, I don't remember, did he win Academy Awards all those years? I mean, but
he won just for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, yeah. He's in Reds. I wouldn't recommend watching Reds. I don't like that movie, but he's great in that. But Jack Nicholson, he's A-OK. And a handsome man. I will fight anyone to the death over that.
Okay. Well, I'm not willing to fight you to the death, Phil. You could just have your own opinion. But
okay. Well, that's fair enough.
All right. I guess.
As for me, I think this
Admit it!
I think this is a fantastic movie. Exceedingly well made. Well acted. Beautifully shot. The plotting is fantastic. The script is great. It's not something I'm going to revisit a lot. And it's not something I revisited since, 25 years ago, the first time I saw it? Because it is so overwhelmingly bleak.
It is a bleak movie.
And I will say that that's also one of the best things about it. But it's also something that makes me not necessarily want to spend a whole lot of time back in that world again, because I know how things go. But yeah, fantastic film. A little bit of a tough watch. But it's definitely one of the greats in my book.
Yeah, I first saw this movie in college, which was only a few years after it came out. And I saw it on projected. It was my college had on weekends, lecture halls were rented out to students groups, and this was one of the favorite movies that student groups would rent and then sell tickets for, because it was a big seller. You know, they'd sell out. And so I saw it probably a couple times projected that way, and then a few times on TV or whatever. It is, for folks who are listening, as far as I know, still going to be on what's the name of that? Canopy, Canopy, which your local library may have a subscription to, and so your library card may get you a way to see this for free. And I thought it looked good on Canopy. So
and if you have HBO Max, it's on HBO Max.
Oh, cool. Yep. I'm a cheapskate, so I did the Canopy route.
Yeah, that's great.
That's the route I took.
No, did you know that your local, seriously, just a little PSA here, your local library will let you check out digital books, and they will probably let you watch movies and TV shows on Canopy, so just ask a friendly local librarian. Yep.
There's Canopy, there's also Hoopla.
There is also Hoopla, yes, indeed.
I have always loved this movie because of the way it is. It has this, as Shelley has said, it's got this 70s vibe sort of in its core, while it's written as a 40s noir. And it's just, yes, everybody's bad because everybody's bad. That's the way it is. And right. The higher up you are, the worse you are until you get to Noah Cross. I am generally not a fan of Faye Dunaway, but I think she's excellent in this movie. And there is a tremendous special effect in this movie is her profile when she's in bed with Jack Nicholson. She's lying on the pillow sideways looking at him, and her hair is somehow, it's as if it's blown back, and her cheekbones, and it's fantastic. It's a great movie. I am happy that this came up and that I was able to jump in and be on this podcast so I could watch it again.
And I will say, I joked about Tunes at the beginning. It shows how sturdy a plot this is, that it is basically the plot of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yes. I should have mentioned that. Yes.
And it doesn't diminish either film. Right. It's a good plot. They just, they don't do the sister daughter thing, but aside from that,
Oh, they should have.
My daughter, my sister, my daughter.
Would have been hilarious.
I'm not bad. I'm drawn that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, hey, Phil, Chinatown.
Yeah.
It's a good movie. Did you
That's
know?
Great.
Yeah. Isn't it great? Yeah. Local man discovers.
Someone should write something about that.
local man discovers classic movie is good. But yes, so and I do think there is something very special and magical about the smelly 70s cinema and film noir being stuck together, you know, stuck together like by some gum you found on the sidewalk, and it's everything is gross and all that, but it somehow it all works together. So thank you for selecting it. I also think Jack Nicholson is good. He is doing the Jack Nicholson thing, but he does it really well. And he does it really well
that.
In this movie. So.
A lot of acting with his eyes in this movie. Check it out.
Well, it's not his nose.
Yeah. No, the nose is not acting.
No, his nose takes the
nose
movie
is
off.
Very method. It's just like
it was probably a bet he had with Robert Evans. It's like, I could act this movie with my nose covered up. I'm that good.
Yeah. He's like, all right, well, let's do
well,
that.
Well, you're on. And so they and so he did.
Oh. The bandage is in the picture.
Well, Phil, how'd we do?
I think it's great. I'm really happy that people enjoyed talking about it, and the best thing about seeing old movies and talking about old movies with your pals is that you get different perspectives and learn different things.
Yeah, like that thing about the horn. You're never going to forget that now.
Yeah,
it's true.
No, absolutely not.
Also, and the next time you watch, just keep an eye out for tuna.
There's tuna everywhere.
It's everywhere.
A lot of tuna in this movie.
Yep.
Sorry, Jake.
That was I was going to say that was the alternate ending.
Sorry, Charlie.
Sorry, Charlie. It's Chinatown. All right. That's it. We're done. Thank you, David J. Lohr.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve Lutz.
Nothing.
Thank you, Jason. Politicians, ugly buildings, and podcasters all get respectable if they last long enough. So I'm proud to be here on this old movie club.
Shelley Brisbane, thank you.
I look forward to joining you again in the future.
Dr. Drang, thank you.
I've got to go ring out my goddamn floor shines.
And Philip Michaels, thank you once again for taking control of old movie club.
Just find the spoiler horn, Mr. Snails.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this latest edition of The Incomparable. We will see you next time.